Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, February 10th, welcome, 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 friends, on into the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cherry.
Yes.
I am going to make a prediction that may turn out to be wildly inaccurate.
Ooh.
But I feel like we are going to look back at this moment and say 10 or 20 years and say this was a crossroads when it comes to social media and society. So social media really took off about 20 years ago, right? And it grew and it grew and it grew. And then there was a little backlash that started to social media. And that backlash grew and grew and grew. And it feels like it's all converging in this moment.
Yeah.
Where we're all trying to decide, will we, can we rein social media in some way? Whether that's government, whether that's, you know, shaming social media into making some reforms. And we're talking about all of this today. And I'm kind of making this prediction in part because there's a pivotal court case happening in California where a plaintiff, a young woman, is accusing several social media companies of contributing to the deterioration of her own mental well-being.
Yeah.
It's drawing some parallels to the early cases against Big Tobacco. Now, we don't know what's going to happen in this case, but we're going to talk about the case today on the show. And then more generally, we're going to use that as a jumping off point to discuss what we should or could do about social media and its impact on mental health, specifically the mental health of young people. We have a question for you this hour. Should big tech be held accountable for the youth mental health crisis? If so, how? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And I say this part with some self-awareness. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
I would love to hear from our audience because a lot of people have young folks in their lives and they've seen the difference between young people who are kind of obsessed and in the rabbit hole of social media and those who are not. So should big tech be held accountable for the youth mental health crisis? 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org.
And speaking of big tech.
Oh, yeah.
Story number one in our trio.
AI-powered SEPTA buses have led to tens of thousands of tickets being issued by the Philadelphia Parking Authority.
I'm getting a ticket from the bus now?
I know. Well, really interesting investigation by NBC 10. It looks at the cost and effectiveness of the PPA program that uses cameras mounted on SEPTA buses to catch people parked or idling in bus lanes. The way it works is the cameras use artificial intelligence to identify cars in the lanes illegally. They take photos and video that a PPA officer then reviews to verify that the car made an infraction or the vehicle made an infraction. After that, the driver will get mailed a $76 ticket. The program only uses about 100 cameras mounted to buses. It launched just 7 months ago. And in that time, PPA has issued 112,000 tickets. That's a lot of tickets.
112K,
tickets. The areas with the most violations, according to NBC 10, are in bus lanes in Center City, in and around Chestnut and Market Streets. And by the way, the city pays about $400,000 a month for the cameras and for services. It cost them so far about $2.8 million, but they have raised in fines $4.3 million. So this project has paid for itself.
Yeah. And so I imagine people are frustrated.
Oh, yeah. They got that bang. That bang. You got that $76 ticket. A little upset.
Now, I'm in the camp of people that doesn't drive very much in Center City. Mm-hmm. And I do take the bus to work a lot. And it is very frustrating that
people
generally have in the past treated the bus lanes as if they're optional. Like the red paint on the street is just like a suggestion or something. And they pull over. A lot of his delivery drivers have some sympathy. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, those lanes are for the buses. And it's to help dozens of people get to where they're going who are on those buses, right?
It's for efficiency.
They said the buses are about 5% faster now. And the idea would be that as people psychologically start to understand that these fines are coming, they will stop treating the bus lanes as optional. Now, someone on YouTube here says, PPA will collect over $8 million from these tickets. It's a money grab.
Yeah, but you know what? It's forcing people to comply and to respect the bus lanes. And they expect that, you know, once people get banged with these fines, that they're that the fines, the revenue will actually go down because more people
they want
will
the
stay
revenue
out
to
of the,
they say they want the revenue to go down.
They'll stay out the bus lane.
Yeah. And there's really no other way to enforce this bus lanes. Now, I think there's a big brother arguing about the tech, and that's a whole other thing, right?
AI, man.
But bus lanes just in general are very hard to enforce because people are constantly, you know,
I hate when I get one of those AI tickets, though, like the red camera ticket. Like, I get mad. Like, those tickets really make me mad.
You'd rather a human give you your ticket.
No, I don't want anyone.
You don't want any tickets. Got it.
I don't want any tickets.
Got it. All right, story number two. So it's not really news that the data centers that are being built all across the country need lots of energy and lots of water. But when you get into the details of any individual project, it's still pretty staggering. And WHYY's Zoe Reed dug into a data center that's being proposed for Newcastle County, Delaware. And the company behind this data center, it's called Project Washington, told Zoe that the facility will use about 12.7 million gallons of water every single year. And this data center, by the way, is not even like close to the most water hungry. There are some that require something like 5 million gallons a day.
Wow. And, you know, we're lucky in our region that we have a robust water supply because some states out west have said that the data center water use would threaten the availability of drinking water.
Yeah.
So that's how much they use. And we're already seeing hikes in energy costs. And this is why we're seeing growing opposition to these data centers. By the way, you know, Pennsylvania wants to be a AI data center hub.
Yeah.
And so that's people are going to need safeguards.
Right. So when you're getting that ticket from the bus, that's costing a lot. It is legitimately.
It's because of the data center.
Well, yeah, that's what's powering it. Yeah. Right? Anyways, so, story number three. Go ahead.
Yeah, this one will maybe make people happy. The statue of famed Philadelphia boxer Joe Frazier could soon be moved to the bottom of the art museum steps. Yes, this is huge news. Last month, the Art Commission voted to move the Rocky statue from the bottom to the top of the art museum steps, where it will be permanently placed beginning this fall. And so the city is now pitching the idea of moving the Smokin' Joe statue from its current location at Xfinity Live in South Philly to the art museum because the former heavyweight champ who lived most of his life in this city ran the art museum steps in real life. He ran through Fairmount Park to train. And Frazier, who passed away in 2011, is part of the inspiration of the fictional Rocky character, and the city wants the world to know that.
So there'll be the Joe Frazier statue where the Rocky statue used to be, and then the Rocky statue at the top of the steps.
Exactly.
It makes a lot of sense to me. By the way, I do have to correct you. It's not Xfinity Live anymore in South Philadelphia.
Oh, sorry.
It's named after a vodka brand now.
Oh.
You got to get that right.
I got to get that. Oh, goodness.
No, but here's the thing. We have to acknowledge that underlying all of this, there's long been a tension around the celebration of Rocky in this city.
Yeah.
Rocky's fictional. There's lots of great Philly boxers who were real. And underlying, Rocky is white. A lot of those boxers are black. And we can't overlook that in this conversation. I think, you know, they could go even further with this. Put the Joe Frazier statue at the bottom of the Rocky steps. But how about an exhibit there about all the great real Philly boxers that made Philly a great boxing city? You know, I'm talking about Bernard Hopkins. I'm talking about
B-Hop.
Joey Giardello. I'm talking about Bad Benny Briscoe, Matthew Saad Muhammad. Lots of great champions and boxers came from this city, and they have been, and it's not by intent, but they have been in some ways overshadowed by Rocky. And I think it would be nice to give them some shine at that specific spot in the city.
Yeah, and by the way, Sylvester Stallone, he's always given props to Philly, and he specifically mentioned Joe Frazier as part of the inspiration. So, you know, but people tend to, when they think of Philly, they think of Rocky, but they need to start thinking of, like you said, all the boxers, and specifically of Joe Frazier, a real-life inspiration. By the way, the Art Commission could vote this week. The city's behind it. The family's behind it. I don't know who would be not
against
behind
it
or against it, so I would say it's about time.
Philly's a boxing mecca. People have to understand that. I mean, even Muhammad Ali lived in Cherry Hill.
Yes, he did. Sonny had a house there.
Sonny Liston lived in Philadelphia when he became, you know, world champion. So there's a lot of great boxing history here that's real. In addition to the great story of Rocky, which should be celebrated as well.
And Frazier was a man of the city, you know, gave to the youth. So let's celebrate him. All right. So we're going to talk about social media today.
We will. And there's a big trial happening out in California right now that's bringing a whole lot of stuff to the surface about what social media companies do with their algorithms and how it affects young people. We want to hear from you today. Should big tech be held accountable for the youth mental health crisis? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Advocates around the world have raised concerns about the negative impact of social media on youth mental health. In December, Australia enacted an outright ban on platforms for teens under age 16.
And this week, there are two court cases underway in the U.S. that seek to hold big tech liable. So today, we're looking at the merits of those cases and asking what the courts and Congress can do to regulate companies like Meta and Google.
Joining us today, we have Haley Hinkle, policy counsel at Fair Play, a nonprofit advocacy group aimed at helping children thrive in a screen-obsessed culture. Haley, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is data scientist and social media accountability advocate Frances Haugen. Frances worked as an algorithmic product manager at Facebook until 2021, when she became a whistleblower and eventually testified to Congress that Facebook consistently chose to maximize its growth rather than implement safeguards for minors. Frances, welcome to Studio 2.
Happy to be here.
And for you at home, on the road, or elsewhere, we want you to participate in the conversation. Our question of the day is, should big tech be held accountable for the youth mental health crisis? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, leave your comments in the chat.
So, Haley, I wanted to start with you to get folks up to speed on this case out in California and what it means. So take us through sort of the 101 of the case itself, and then what the potential basic outcomes are here.
Yeah, absolutely. So the trial that began last week is the case of a young girl going by the initials KGM, or I believe now we have her first name, Kaylee. And it's against Meta and Google. It's part of a consolidated set of over 2,000 cases in California state court on behalf of individuals and families related to their harmful experiences with four major social media platforms, Snapchat, TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram. In the last couple of weeks, Snap and ByteDance both settled so that Snapchat and TikTok are no longer part of this particular case with the plaintiff KGM. But basically, the purpose of this particular trial is what we call a bellwether trial in complex litigations where a lot of cases are brought together because they share some common issues or common procedural matters that need to be established. The attorneys for both sides of the case will decide on some representative cases to bring to trial, bring before a jury, and try to see how maybe some shared issues can be resolved or are typically resolved, how the court deals with specific evidentiary issues, things of that nature.
And Haley, I want to jump in because one of the things that stood out to me about this case was the fact that they use a very unique legal argument comparing social media to big tobacco. Tell me about why this stands out and what and why this case is so unique and what you think it'll tell about the future of cases like this.
Yeah, this case is unique because it's really the first time we are seeing a case go to trial where the questions at issue are really how major social media companies acted with respect to children and teenagers. What kinds of decisions did they make? And were their decisions ones that a reasonable person would consider, frankly, harmful? This is taken this long for us to get to trial on these types of questions because There are certain immunities, and we can talk about Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act that the social media companies have used really for decades to avoid having to answer these questions. In this case, it's being compared to a big tobacco moment because these industries have some parallels, I think, for families and advocates in that they are large and powerful, in that we see they hold a lot of information about how their product affects the people who use it and affects it in a harmful way, that they also tend to influence the information that comes out in terms of research, or they pay to influence nonprofit advocacy even. But that ultimately we're having a day in court here where people are going to learn more about what they knew and when and how, and that will bring a reckoning perhaps similar to what we saw in the 1990s.
And by the way, our question for all you listening today, should big tech be held accountable for the youth mental health crisis? If so, how? 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. Going back to this parallel between big tech and big tobacco. For something like a tobacco product, I would imagine, epidemiologically, you could pretty easily say, look, if someone uses tobacco a certain amount, they're X percent more likely to get lung cancer, for instance, or to have emphysema. When you talk about the effect of a product on someone's mental health, I would imagine, sort of legally and even just beyond legally, it's a little squishier. It's harder to say A caused B. So, Francis, I'm curious, how you might make that case, given that, when we're talking about cause and effect here, it might be a little trickier.
For context, some people have been describing this court case as like the first time these issues have come to trial. And in the United States, it's definitely the first time they've come to trial. But what we saw internationally is cases have come to trial in places like the UK, where I'm going to Haley, maybe you can help me here. Is it Emily? Who's the girl who unfortunately
Molly
died a few
Rose.
years ago? Molly Rose. Molly Russell, I think. She was by
Russell,
Molly
thank
Rose.
you.
Yeah, Molly Russell. This young woman, Molly Russell, 13 years old, died. And one of the things that came out as a result of her coroner's inquest, so they had basically a judicial hearing on did this child die because of social media, was by the time she died, half of her feed was pro self-harm content. So this is a 13-year-old girl where the algorithms have noticed, oh, there's this topic. We are agnostic the topic. It's like we don't really understand the significance of any given topic we show you, but we know that people who engage with self-harm content tend to engage with more of it. And because of that pattern, no one set out to kill this child, but because no one was looking for these kinds of vulnerabilities, even after they were reported repeatedly, and then by the time she died, half her feed was encouraging her to harm
And
herself.
Francis, as
So
someone who
that's the kinds of
understands,
questions we're asking.
yeah, and as someone who understands how these algorithms work from the inside, I think what you're saying is that you could easily make an algorithm that could identify certain topics as harmful and not feed them the way it would feed your interest in, taco trucks or something like that. Like that would be, that's technologically feasible. Is that right?
So one of the documents that I brought out, at this point 5 years ago, talked about how, you can use users' feedback. You can go out there and say, hey, does this content make you feel bad about your body? And ask the users. So it's not even the platform saying what content is quote good or what content is bad. You can ask users and say, when you see content like this, does it make you feel bad about yourself? And you could imagine a world where, maybe Facebook and Instagram had implemented a feature where if someone started looking at more and more content that people had said, this makes me feel bad about my body, or said, looked at more and more content where people said, this makes me want to hurt myself. Imagine if there had been a feature that said, hey, we noticed you're kind of going down the rabbit hole. Do you want to continue? Those kinds of features are not about the government saying what you can and can't access. They're about designing for the vulnerabilities of algorithms that are blind. And we can do that today.
I want you to sort of, Francis, explain to us sort of how Facebook, Instagram, and some of these companies, how they actually make money, and why the idea, why they are incentivized to not do the types of things you're saying that they could easily do to keep people from falling in these rabbit holes.
So to take a step back and think a little bit about the tobacco lawsuit. You know, we forget as people living in 2026 that it used to be we sold cigarettes from stands that were at the eye level of small children, right? They were in front of the counter or they were on the side of the wall at your gas station, and anyone could say shoplift cigarettes, which I found out later my husband used to do when he was like nine. And we hear, talk about these things and it sounds absurd, right? And I think one of the things that we forget is that the platforms are living in this in-between moment where, like, imagine the tobacco companies have said, "Ooh, you know, we're going to change a bunch of ways we sell cigarettes because we think we may be accidentally targeting children." Then there would have been a conversation about, "Oh, you're selling cigarettes to children." Similarly, the social media companies today, they worry about, I cannot read Mark Zuckerberg's mind. I cannot read Guy Rosen's, sorry, Adam Mosseri's mind, the head of Instagram. But I can imagine them sitting around our own being like, "Hey, we don't want to start the conversation about social media being dangerous because we don't want people to say, maybe my kids shouldn't use it." And if you notice, they've only launched big waves of safety features on like the night before a law will go into effect, or like in the weeks before Australia announced they might ban social media. And so they've been afraid to start the conversation, but now they're kind of stuck
Forced
playing
to.
catch up.
They're forced to, yeah.
So what could they be
Yeah.
forced to do here, Haley? So let's talk about, there's a case here in California. There's also one in New Mexico. If we imagine that the plaintiffs or the state is successful in those two cases, there's going to be direct consequences tied to that case, but then there's also the downstream consequences of whatever else that could open up. Give us an idea of what that world looks like, Haley Hinkle.
Yeah, so if the juries find in these cases, on the legal questions that companies like Meta and Google, Snap and TikTok as well, in other cases, were reason knew or should have known they were reasonably likely to cause harm, should have warned, a reasonable person should would have warned a plaintiff like KGM or the other children and families that are in these lawsuits, then we might see, and this will be one trial, but there will be many others, or two trials when we add New Mexico. We might see these companies start to change their calculus when they have to pay out damages. I think that some of these plaintiffs will really also be seeking in their negotiations, if they can reach settlement with the platform, more systematic promises for more systematic change. So we might see the parties themselves asking them to change certain features. But the damages as well will really change the calculus for these companies on the risk versus reward of using certain design features or making certain business decisions that are really targeted at extending kids' time. And it may now be that, oh, well, for all the ad revenue we could get for that amount of extra time online, we're going to face potential civil liability in court with a jury because we, changed A, B, and C thing about the platform in order to keep that kid's eyeballs online.
Yeah. And I wonder this, and Haley touched on something that triggered something in my mind, Francis, because one of the things about social media companies is that they've been very opaque. Like, most people have no idea how they work. And I'm thinking, like, just the fact that now, because these lawsuits have been filed, we have a better understanding of how things work under behind that curtain, behind that screen. Do you think that at the very least, these lawsuits will help regulators or help parents, or because we had no idea, and people, I don't think the average person knew that social media companies were so much incentivized to get you to fall down this rabbit hole. And I'm talking to you, Francis, sorry.
The yeah. So I to give help people get a little bit more context. So it can kind of feel like we are swimming in an information environment where it's, quote, obvious that social media is harmful to kids, or that you watch, these kids who are doom scrolling at 2 a.m. because they just cannot put down the social media app. But we need to roll back in time to before I came forward as a whistleblower. During that, so that's 2021, during the 5 years before that, Facebook had invested extensively in both lobbying to governments and in funding academics who were willing to talk about these issues in terms of ambiguity, of saying, like, well, the evidence just really isn't in. Like, it's hard to prove these things. When Facebook had the data, They had run the experiments. They had seen the kids say, yeah, it's easier for me to sleep if you don't send me a notification at 11 p.m. at night. It's easier for me to focus in school if you don't send me a notification in the middle of math class. They knew these things. They'd run the experiments. They had talked to the kids. And yet, to the public, they kept saying, nothing can be known. Like, these things are too complicated. Who knows why these things are happening? And now we can read that they knew when they knew it, and that they knew that there were other ways forward.
Wow.
So if I'm big tech, I'm saying, look, there's a million products out here that are engineered to make people like them. And in fact, that's kind of the point of making a product. You're trying to make something that people want to buy. Big food does it. Big what you but big in front of almost any word, they're doing the same thing. What makes what we're doing worse, and why should we be held liable for it? Because ultimately, anyone who makes a product is trying to get people to want that product. So it goes to this question for me, Francis, of what's the difference between making something addictive and between making a product that people just want? Where do you draw that line?
Well, I think there's questions on scale, right? So there's very, very few products that people have built out there that people spend 2 hours or more with every day. And there's very few products that have network effects. So in the case of things like Instagram, like if we were to go out there, I think this is a great parallel to cigarettes. If you poll most smokers, they say, yeah, I wish I could quit. You know, if you polled most people in the opiates lawsuits, you said, hey, do you want to quit? They say, yeah, I'd really like to quit. If you talk to kids, a huge fraction of kids say, I wish I didn't have to use this, but the thing I would have to sacrifice to go off is my peer group. Like, I'd have to be ostracized if I left. And so when you have products for people, the users of them actually say, I don't like using this. I wish I didn't have to. That's a perfect opportunity to step in and say, maybe we are dealing with a different kind of problem and we need to have different kinds of interventions. And that could be as simple as, you know, we talked about lack of transparency before. Probably the next most famous Facebook whistleblower is an engineer named Arturo Bejar. And he ran experiments at Instagram where they went out and polled kids and asked them questions like, did you receive an unwanted sexual message in the last 7 days? And they found that 1 in 8 girls between the ages of 13 and 15, and that really means, you know, 7 and 15, said that they got 1 in 8, so they got an unwanted sexual message in the last 7 days. And in his Senate testimony, he said, until Instagram has to report publicly next to their profit and loss numbers every quarter how many kids got unwanted sexual messages, that number will not go down. And we need to accept, unless we get inside that veil, unless we can look behind the curtain, these problems will continue unabated.
And I hear all of what Francis is saying, Haley, and I think, you know, there's a really strong argument that, you know, what the social media companies knew, what they were doing, it's definitely red flags. But one of the reasons why these cases could not be consolidated is because the facts are so different, and it will be hard to prove causation. And so I want you to talk about that point, that causation point, and how, you know, what do you know about how plaintiffs are planning to draw this dotted line from all the things that Francis is talking about, that social media companies knew, that safeguards they had available that they didn't employ, and yet the outcomes that you're seeing from these young people, how are they going to draw this dotted line?
Yeah, that's an excellent question because I think, as Frances said, so much of the social media companies' work of the last decade or so has been to really fixate on that question, and even to kind of confuse the evidence at times, but to make it very hard, you know, get everyone caught up on the idea of how will we prove that this child's mental health was, you know, mental state was directly impacted and the negative aspects were caused by social media. But we're really actually looking at something a bit more nuanced here. You know, the question will be, as they kind of went over in opening arguments yesterday, whether social media was a substantial factor for KGM. Would a reasonable person consider this to have contributed to her mental health state? And I think that that piece is going to be really similar across a lot of these cases. It's not going to be 100% where the majority of a given child's negative mental health outcomes traceable back to specific features or specific things about the social media platforms they were using. There's going to be a question about what Meta and Google in this case knew and how they acted on it. And I think that's the case the plaintiffs are really setting up to make, is to say, look at all this evidence, the types of evidence that Francis and Arturo have brought to light, but much more that has come through discovery. And was this a company that was really acting reasonably with respect to the health of a child, in this case, KGM?
Let me read in a couple comments. This is Deja who says, I think not only should they be thinking about kids, but also be held liable when they are actively promoting fraudulent propaganda. These platforms are being used to change the outcomes of elections, which directly affects many people's lives. Meanwhile, the CEOs are floating around the Caribbean somewhere in their $500 million yachts. George says social media platforms should bear responsibility for what they post and promote. We wouldn't let a newspaper print blatant lies without repercussions. Why let social media platforms do the same and let them use algorithms to drive the BS toward people while profiting off their data? So those two comments, I think, Haley, get to a larger point here. The difference between a social media platform as a publisher and a newspaper, or us here at a radio station. If we here knowingly said something false, and you could prove that we knew it was false and it did harm to someone, you could hold us liable. Social media companies seem to exist legally in a different space because, Facebook isn't the one making the post, they're hosting the post. So I guess from a legal perspective, Haley, why might that matter or not matter?
It matters a lot because we have a law called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act that says that for online services like social media companies, they can't be held responsible, they can't be held civilly liable for and treated as the publisher or speaker of the words of a third party. And that really came to be in order to make it a bit easier for things like message boards to exist in the early days of the internet. Congress recognized, as the courts were trying to wrestle with these sort of parallels to newspapers, that it would be, hard for these companies to these websites, then they weren't mega companies, but these websites to really exist if they could be held liable for anything somebody posts on the board, and they have to monitor everything that's there. The sort of, I think, distinction that we're really finally hitting on, as so many cases are coming to trial, is that there are big decisions that the platforms make about how they're designed that, regardless of the content of any given post or set of posts that a child is seeing, we know have negative outcomes. And that's where we get to the things like Francis was talking about with rabbit holes, the programming of an algorithm to give you more and more and more of the same. We keep finding that gets you to more and more extreme content. And as a child, as your brain is developing, as you have a lot going on chemically, and you can be very sensitive to, shocking content, for example, that can have really, really negative impacts. And so that's what the attorneys here will be sort of drilling down on, is the types of design choices that influence what's put in front of a child and how hard it is to log off or look away.
And I wonder, Francis, because, you've said that, these companies didn't want users, they wanted addicts. And so I want you to just kind of quickly, because we only have a couple minutes left in this segment, just kind of say what kind of things could these companies put in place that would stop this rabbit hole, that would prevent young people from becoming addicts of their products?
So I don't think I've used quite that aggressive of wording. What I would say is that they didn't want to ask questions. They didn't want to look at the dark corners of their products because that might require them to take responsibility or to do something. To give you a sense of like where there's really, really easy things, I would say most people don't suffer from severe compulsive use of social media. But you can imagine more assertively taking people who maybe have been on for really long streaks or who are opening the app 100 times a day, 50 times a day. Remember, kids are spending something like 3.5 hours on social media per day. It's some huge window. You can imagine coming in there and just giving them more tools, making them more aware, because even little bits of friction profoundly change behavior.
Yeah.
And right now, the platforms will say, well, we have a lot of those tools. But if you go and try to figure out how to actually turn them on, it'll be buried deep in settings. Or, as Arturo showed just a few months ago, many of the safety features that Facebook claimed were available for Instagram, excuse me, Meta claimed were available for Instagram, no longer operate, or you can't trigger them in the app anymore. And that's a great example of how sometimes safety just becomes other kinds of marketing.
We're coming up on a break here, and we have to say bye to both of you. But real quick, Francis, when you add up all of the tools that are at the disposal of the big tech companies, and you imagine them all being applied together, could you create a safe and still somewhat open social media platform?
100%. You know, one of the things that I think is really encouraging about looking at, say, the Senate testimony from Arturo Bejar, is he talks about how powerful it is just to listen to kids. You know, a lot of the, for example, predators that go and prey on kids on these platforms, if we took more seriously people, or when kids complained that this stranger had contacted them and made them feel uncomfortable, it's a very small number of adults that are the problem. But if we're unwilling to have hard conversations about the dark corners of social media, we're never going to be able to get even close to making social media that is good for kids and that we feel safe about.
Mm. That is Francis Haugen, a Facebook whistleblower, data scientist, and social media accountability advocate. Francis, thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2. And let me also thank Haley Hinkle, policy counsel at Fair Play, a nonprofit helping children thrive in an increasingly commercialized, screen-obsessed culture. Haley, appreciate your time on Studio 2.
Thanks so much.
And in just a moment, we'll be back with a public health expert who says regulating tech companies isn't enough, that we need to look in the mirror if we want real change. We'll talk about that after the break. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. We're not going anywhere. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We're talking this hour about the lawsuits underway aimed at holding social media companies accountable for doing harm to minors. But even if the courts or Congress take action, will that be enough?
Our guest now says, maybe not. Brian C. Castrucci is the president and CEO of the De Beaumont Foundation, an organization aimed at improving well-being through strengthening public health. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And we want to hear from you listening right now. Should big tech be held accountable for the youth mental health crisis? If so, how? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you were on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And so, Brian, policymakers, they're debating stronger youth protections, including age limits, bans. But enforcement and privacy are major obstacles. And I want to just sort of talk to you and have us talk through what policymakers are getting wrong and their urgency to just do something.
Doing something's not the problem. We absolutely should do something. We want companies that are behaving appropriately. But a public health approach to social media requires us to be much more holistic. And I talk about this as a parent and as a public health practitioner. I have a 14 and a 16-year-old. And I've seen the downside of social media, but I've also seen the positives. I mean, my daughter made butter the other night because she saw someone do it on YouTube. It was really good butter. It was a little oversalted,
yeah,
but it was good
yeah,
butter.
Yeah.
So we need to really think about how we're tackling this problem. It's no different than other challenges in our society like marijuana or guns. Like, these are things that are here. We can't simply legislate our way out of these problems. We need to include digital literacy in elementary school through high school. We need to teach parents how to talk about social media use. But we can't simply just legislate this and think it's going to go away.
Alicia comments, yes, hold the companies accountable. Mm-hmm. They create an addictive, harmful product that pushes harmful content to young children. It's like giving kids drugs or a gun, etc. And then saying, oh, yes, but we aren't responsible. There's no moral compass at these companies. They need to be held accountable. Now, on YouTube, DTL5110 says it's the parent's responsibility. If a parent knows their child has mental health issues, they need to monitor their social media. Okay, so you mentioned social media literacy, Brian. But when I hear that, sometimes I think of a boring class in school that everyone has to attend and no one actually pays attention in. So what's a type of social media literacy that could actually change the behavior of young people and make them safer?
Policies work. I think some of the last guests talked about some of the friction points. Hey, you've been on for 2 hours. Hey, you've been on for 4 hours. But what we're not getting is like, what is the quality of that 4 hours? What if that 4 hours was me researching something for a class? What if that 4 hours was me having connections with a friend in Australia and I'm learning about their culture? We need to be more nuanced. And we're not, as a culture right now, nuance is not doing so well. We like kind of broad sweeping, interventions that fix everything. And those just don't exist, especially in an overly politicized space, right? This is a First Amendment issue. This is about, kids engaging both socially and in an online space, which can be dangerous. Because I think what we all know is that predators go to where kids are.
Yeah.
And you can't chase the predators out of all these spaces. I mean, I'm in my 50s. I remember predators hanging out at the arcade when arcades were a thing. Right. So you didn't shut down the arcade. There are ways that you could try to move those predators out. But I think, as the last guest said, listening to the kids, making sure that we're acting on that, but also saying to the kids, this is what is acceptable behavior. This is what's not acceptable behavior. And this isn't, it's not going to be a class taught by your third grade teacher. Right. That just becomes cringy. Like you said, Avi, it's like when they taught us sex ed in fifth grade, yeah. It's just cringy. Yeah. But it has to be an ongoing conversation with parents and kids. It has to be something between older siblings. Say like, hey, what are you doing online? Can I see? I mean, anytime I say to my daughter, hey, let me see your phone. She's like, why? It's my phone. I'm like, no, it's not. It's my phone. I get to see it.
Yeah.
But it does require us to have some level of responsibility as parents. And again, I say this both as public health practitioner and struggling parent of a 14 and a 16 year old.
We have the real Lachman online who says, I bear significant responsibility to my daughter's social media usage. I cannot say that it is entirely Facebook or Snap or any other social media's fault. I want to bring in a caller. We have John from East Greenville on the line. John, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is that one of the problems with social media is they rely on profits. And so their whole model is getting people addicted to it. And so then they try to keep the conversations going, whatever direction the kids are going. So why not have similar to public radio, have a public social media that doesn't rely solely on profits?
Interesting. John from East Greenville, that could be an option, right? Somebody could create that. I do have a question for you, Brian, because we had a guest, we talked about social media, we talked about smartphones a while back, and it was proposed that, we just give kids these phones. We give kids access to all sorts of apps without any training, in order to get a car, you have to get a driver's license. I want your thoughts about some interventions that parents can put in place, and they might be uncomfortable, right? Because you got to have a conversation with a 13-year-old, and we know how 13-year-olds can be. But are there some interventions that parents can put in place? Some, you need to do this before you get access to X. Are there certain things or steps that you think parents should force their children to walk before they get access to social media and smartphones and other things?
I think you are absolutely spot on. My son just got his learner's permit and he can't drive without me in the car or another licensed driver. And that's, graduated driver's licenses have reduced mortality associated with driving among teens because we put some guardrails there. Now, we're not going to have the government saying to us, here are all the guardrails for the parents. But this is something social media companies and parents need to work on. Parent advocacy groups need to have a toolkit, a booklet. This is how you introduce social media to your kids. Those are the helpful things that we can have as parents. And I just want to, you know, as we have this conversation about social media and profit and the role of business in America, I mean, we have to just reflect on ourselves that if you're willing to limit social media for their behavior, are you equally willing to do it to alcohol companies or gun manufacturers? So just like watch the slippery slope of what are we willing to do? What, if social media companies are somehow, you know, well, they're acting as bad actors, but gun manufacturers are somehow morally on the high ground. That doesn't make logical sense. And so this is a huge challenge. We don't want social media companies behaving in a way that makes them predatory to children, but they do have a business model and there's some benefit to it. I think there's significant benefit. And even like in the last segment, you had people talking about the truths that are on social media. And I think that's part of the challenge right now in America. What is truth, right? Who gets to decide it? Is it the administration? Is it me? Is it you guys? You know, who gets to decide what is true and what is not true outside of math? I'm pretty confident 2 + 2 is still 4, but I haven't checked social media yet today.
Yeah. I'm sure you could find some dissenting voices on that. Either way, I want to read this interesting comment on YouTube from K Zuber Tech. I'm a parent and I work in IT. I have lots of guardrails on my devices, but kids can use their school devices to make these accounts or use it without our knowledge. So those computers need to come with their own guardrails, and it's its own issue. Mm-hmm. What that brings up for me, Brian, is a broader problem, which is that if you are between the ages, let's just say, of like 12 and 18, one of your great desires in life, whether you're born now or any period prior, is to have a space away from your parents, with your peers, that is sort of self-governed and a place of self-discovery. And I don't know how you have that on social media while also having the guardrails that everyone seems to think we need to have. Can you help me understand how we might go about that?
You can't bubble wrap your kids. You just can't. Like I'm having a lot of anxiety as a parent of a 16-year-old, right? He's driving and I'm really close to him driving by himself. Mm-hmm. And that is petrifying. And then my son is 2 years away from going to college. And that petrifies me. I know what I did in college. It petrifies me even more, right? I think we all have that moment that we were like, I could have died that mm-hmm. time in college did that. And we know that, and it scares the living daylights out of me. I have to give him the tools that I can give him. And then I gotta hope, which is a really not the best kind of strategy, but it is. Like, I have to hope that he is going to apply those tools in the best way possible. And that he avoids the harm that not everyone can avoid. And I just think it's a reality. We can't, whether if those guardrails come off, whether they come off at 18 or 18 in a day, those guardrails come off. What we need to do, we have opened this Pandora's box. One of the previous callers said social media has changed the outcomes of elections. Yes, it has. And we now need to deal with the fact that we opened Pandora's box and a lot of scary stuff came out.
Yep.
And now that's part of our entire culture. And we have to do a better job of teaching kids how to deal with things. It's very similar to legalization around marijuana. That was a huge Pandora's box that hasn't been opened on society. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but I'm saying we have to be thoughtful about it, right? The quality of the marijuana, the strength of it. How do we sell it? Should we still be selling marijuana gummies that look like bears? Because I don't think many adults really care about that.
And there's a lot of debate about how to do that. And I want to try to squeeze in one more caller before, because we only have a couple minutes. Lauren from Philadelphia is on the line. Lauren, you're on Studio 2. We have a very short time. What's your question or comment?
More of a comment. I love information, social literacy for children. I would just hope as a society and a culture that the adults and the parents are modeling the behavior that we're asking these kids to do, because you see adults just down on their phones like, what are we all doing? And if we're demanding so much of our children, should we not also be expecting it and modeling that behavior as adults?
Thank you. That's Lauren from Philadelphia. And so, Brian, as we wrap up, I got to ask you, I mean, the social media, the companies moving at lightning speed, it's hard for us to keep up. If you were to give one piece of advice on how to stay ahead of this and train your kids and train yourself to have good practices, what would that piece of advice be?
We need to absolutely have conversations with our kids about this on a daily basis. We need to look at changes in their behavior. You need to actually have a relationship with your kids and have hard conversations. And you know what? If you as a parent are nervous about social media, cut it off, right? You can cut it off and put some guardrails of your own. But to think that we're going to have a court case outcome or we're going to have a policy that solves all of it, I think that's naive.
That is Brian Castrucci, President and CEO of the De Beaumont Foundation. Brian, appreciate your time today on Studio 2.
Thank you. This was fun.
Let me read a few more comments. Mm-hmm. Citizen Dave says, I think guardrails should be created. However, parents have the ultimate responsibility to safeguard their children. Natasha says, is it true that big tech CEOs and execs don't let their kids use social media? If so, that says something about what they know and about the harm social media does to kids. I don't know if that's true or not. Yeah, maybe they do, maybe they don't. But certainly there's a broader movement afoot for people to curtail their kids' social media use, and I'm sure in Silicon Valley and elsewhere.
Yeah, and it just goes to show that while we can put responsibility on tech companies, we have a lot of responsibility that we hold within ourselves. And know who holds a lot of responsibility for our show? Our producers. And we couldn't do this without them. So I want to say thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Thanks also to our visual producer, Mike Schiffler, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.